You are listening to Fantha Tracks.
Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Time to get all your Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Mulcaster.
That's not true.
You're listening to Making Tracks and a very special episode as we return to Hotel Finsa 1222 on the weekend of the 23rd to the 25th of February 2024. Fantha Tracks were there presenting panels. The first was presented by Brian Cameron. The second featured a Q&A with guests former 20th Century Fox CEO Harold Lestat, special effects technician Martin Gant and production assistant Christian Berham. Myself and Brian sat down and quizzed them about the making of The Empire Strikes Back. So here we are with our very special panel here on Making Tracks.
Right, let's get this Q&A started. So earlier on today, Brian did loads of work researching a Lucasfilm-focused article about what happened, the making of Star Wars here in Finsa, and all the details that went with that. We made a big point of saying this is Lucasfilm's version, this is what they've put out into the world. A lot of factual inaccuracies there may be, which we will dig into.
Yeah. I also misspoke, I think, because I said Pinewood and not Elstree, of course.
You did.
Yeah, so if you're here this morning, it's Elstree, not Pinewood.
There you go. So, other than that, introduced to the stage, let's get some guys up on the stage. We're going to start digging into this panel. Christian, round of applause, people.
Can I just say a word?
Of course you can.
One of the things that is maybe worth mentioning that I've noticed through the years, probably less so with you guys who are, you know, information freaks. I mean, you know probably more about Star Wars than I do. But the Americans, it was almost policy to play down the fact that these films were made in Britain. I won't say that they actively lied about it, but they certainly didn't publicise the fact that the main unit shoots were done in London. And while I was working on Empire at Elstree, a friend of mine went to the States, and she said that she, you know, through her trip, she had told people, "Ah, a friend of mine is working on Star Wars 2." And people were saying, no, Star Wars, well, no, that's a Hollywood film. Mm. So, you know.
That's a good point, though, yeah. Because, as you say,
the truth is,
don't let the truth get in the way of a good lie.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
We had a nice opening shot there, of Hoff coming in the background.
A cameo.
Yeah.
So the Q&A earlier, as you say, Brian did a lot of research from the Lucasfilm point of view. And we don't have to do it in any particular order, whatever comes to mind first. Anything that leaps to mind that you would see and say in there that you thought, well, that's not quite how it shook down. Anything, whichever one of you guys wants to speak first.
Christian mentioned something while we were out doing the walk around the hotel, as we started outside, the fact that it said that at both Kurtz Base and Sharman Base, there were four huts. One hut.
I don't know where they got that from.
Right.
And everything was operated from those single huts. Everything was done
I don't think they were ever used.
I was never into them.
I think that, I mean, there's that one photograph that you showed earlier,
yes, yeah,
of the construction crew hiding from the weather eating porridge.
Yes.
Where was that?
That was on the top, I think.
That was on the top.
I think it was on the very top, yes.
Yes, I think.
So that was one of them.
One of them, yes.
But that's the only picture I've ever seen of any of them being used. Yeah. In fact, what I remember from, what was the top one? Was that Kurtz or Sharman?
Kurtz.
Was that when we came here, when we eventually got up to the top, they couldn't find it.
No. Okay.
there were, you know, all of these 2.5 meter high sticks that were showing the route. There was like that much of them. So much snow had come that hut disappeared.
So instead of really being functional bases, there were more marker points.
They were marker points. Yeah. I don't think they had any practical use for us, for the crew. But then, as you pointed out earlier, what was planned was very different from what was achieved because the weather was so appalling.
So from this isn't to make any apologies for Lucasfilm, but from a Lucasfilm point of view, they may have had a breakdown of what they were expecting to build at those two camps, which might have said 4 huts.
Yeah.
But in reality, there was the one.
Yeah.
Any other things leap out? Because we're quite into dissecting these things, because we know you guys were all there and you've got recollection from discussing these things.
Again, Christian and I were talking about outside the hotel that our friend there asked me yesterday about, you know, where was the trench shot? Where was that? And Christian and I were exchanging notes, and, you know, In the chaos of filming, we all had our focus on our particular jobs, and it was just, okay, get into the snow track and follow the convoy. Mm. And the weather was blowing like crazy. You didn't know where you were.
No,
you could have been anywhere.
Yeah.
You had this little windscreen wiper window through the front, and it was just white out there. I mean, I got no idea where we went up there. No idea at all.
No.
I got one, again, we were exchanging notes earlier. There was one of the vehicles that had very wide tracks. Mm. I don't know what it was called.
Rat track?
Was it a rat track?
I think it was.
A rat track one.
That had an enormously powerful engine. It was, I think it was a straight 8-cylinder, I mean a big motor.
Yeah.
And that thing could go up 45 degrees, you know, with these incredibly wide tracks. And that had to tow all of our snowcats up individually, up one steep path, to get to the top where we filmed. Yeah. And what we filmed up there, I can't remember.
No, me neither. In terms of locations, then, is that, I mean, for you guys, in a practical sense, when you're working on it, is it an advantage that a lot of it kind of looked the same? And is it an advantage that one day you can film down there, it looks one way because the snow's blowing that way, and the next day it's blowing a different direction? Is that an advantage or a disadvantage?
Well, as far as we're concerned, you know, at our level, it makes no difference at all, because we're just doing what we're told.
Sure.
We're not the decision makers. We weren't the decision makers. We just go, we went where we were pointed.
Yeah.
And did our little bit of the overall picture.
Yeah.
Now, they chose a position for the probe robot. That was something that the effects department had a lot to do with. You know, we were heavily involved in the building of it and the tracks and the motors. And I had to go up there and help get it all working and then pack it up in black plastic bags to protect it from snow overnight and then go back for the shoot. But where it was, you know, I couldn't tell you.
No. Just putting the market down wouldn't work, would it?
No. But, you know, it was somebody else's job to get me up there.
Sure.
So, you know, I mean, it is. It's a film work. It's very compartmentalised.
Yeah.
You do the bit that you're told to do, and that's, you know, you have a Phil Kohler, the location manager. It was his responsibility to get together with the transport people to get us where we had to go. Mm. Wasn't necessary for us to know where that was.
No. Just to get there.
Just to get there.
I never looked at the map.
No.
I mean, in the presentation earlier, Brian put up the map with the different places and different areas, the original map. I mean, I'm assuming that would have been the map you guys roughly worked from, or something of its type.
It was of no purpose to me. You know, we were told, okay, tomorrow we've got to prepare the battle site. So we had our snow track and the trailer behind it. So we filled the trailer up with the metal boxes that the explosives went into. If every individual explosion had a metal box, like a square-sided steel, welded from steel plates. It's just so that you don't blow stones up in the air.
Right.
Mm. You have this metal container that the explosives go into, and then cement or peat or cork or safe things to throw up into the air. So we, you know, you load all the stuff you need and the cables and the batteries and
yeah.
and get in the thing, and then you're driven. You know, I didn't need a map because I didn't have to get it wasn't my responsibility to get me to the right place.
Gotcha, gotcha. You didn't drive either.
I didn't drive either. No.
Harold, one of the things that really fascinated me was how open Lucasfilm were with what was happening in Norway, in terms of they announced that they had the poster that everyone got in their gift packs of R2 on the skis, the press conference, and even releasing an image from the shoot whilst it was going on. Was that very much conscious decision making to be very open, because the publicity around Star Wars at that time must have been an immense amount of pressure?
Well, in the weeks before shooting, we didn't get many instructions from Lucasfilm, so it was the local 20th Century Fox office that arranged the press conference. It was a friend of mine making this R2-D2 on skis. That was my idea. Yeah. We have to have a local thing to show and to use in the papers, and so we were very free to do whatever we could. And yeah. and Lucasfilm did not interfere with anything in the beginning, really. Yeah. So we had a great time. Yeah.
But it would be interesting to find out whether any of that information that Harold arranged for the Norwegian press reached America, mm-hmm. whether Lucasfilm decided to use that to publicize it in America, because, as I say, I don't think they were very keen on...
No. But the interesting thing, I hadn't seen that poster before of R2 before I started doing research for coming here.
Oh, there you are.
So that maybe partly answers it.
That's a friend of mine making that drawing.
Yeah.
And he also we used him a lot to make fronts on cinemas, and we had openings, and he's a very good artist, really. So.
Okay. I just think it's interesting that in Imogen, obviously the UK doesn't get the recognition that it should have got for the films being made there. And now here you are, Empire. This is the external location for the films being made. Norwegian Star Wars fans obviously are proud of it, but Norway, Fox Norway as was, of course, must have had an immense sense of ownership for that big production coming here.
Yeah. Mm. And Gary Church gave us we could do the most of it locally.
Yeah.
He was very open, and we always informed him. And he said yes to everything we suggested. So it was easy to cooperate with Gary Kurtz the year before and during the shooting. So we invited the press from the international press here, and we did all that because he said, okay, that's your business. So he was very, very open. Maybe he was a little too open for George Lucas. We don't know, but we know the history, so it could be something there. But he was very easy to work with, and I'm very happy that today I'm living in Gary Kurtz's room.
Yeah.
That was very good.
Martin, you're going to say something?
No, just to pick up what you said, that England should have got recognition. I'm not sure. You know, of course, all the English people working on the crew, you want your contribution acknowledged. But in terms of marketing the film, perhaps Lucasfilm were correct in thinking to paint it as an entirely American film would be a better marketing strategy.
Yeah.
Could well be. That from their point of view,
sure,
play down the English stuff, and you know, so that it's more thoroughly 100% Hollywood film.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's a good point, because the UK had that great reputation from the tax breaks and various things, but great crews. So a lot of American productions, Superman came here, and all the Lucas and Spielberg stuff came here.
So obviously the UK had a great rep to a point when the economic situation changed. But yeah, that's probably quite a good point. That
all of the Raiders films, for example, you know, they were all made at Elstree, but you don't hear an awful lot about that. Like, maybe more nowadays because there are more people like you. There are more people that are interested in the making of and you know, the details.
Yeah.
But the general cinema going public, they're not interested. You know,
they just want the
stars that they're interested in, not the background stuff.
Good point.
Hello, this is Mark Thompson. I narrate a bunch of the Star Wars audiobooks, and you're listening to Fanthatrax.
Do or do not. There is no try.
Christian, working on the film, when you first came across the project, being aware of what you were going to do, first things first, I mean, to us, Martin makes a great point that Star Wars is, you know, it's a big deal and fans are into it. We dig into the history of it now, like archaeology almost. How aware were you of Star Wars at all when you first came across it?
I was asked by Svein Johansen, who's the Norwegian production manager. I worked with him a lot. Fantastic guy, best first assistant director I worked with in my life. And he asked me if I wanted to join him on this production. And I said, what's that, Star Wars? And I've seen something about it in newspapers. And it was probably late 78. And I think it was you, Harald, who rented Colosseum and showed us number one for us. For Elin, Hilde, Svein, and me. So and I was deeply asleep when it finished.
Christian is one of the few persons I know that have been working on The Empire Strikes Back for 3, 4, 5 months. And he said, and I didn't like the film. No. I slept. So, but we rented. I told some people here the other day that probably the nicest cinema in Europe, Colosseum Cinema in Oslo, and the group of us,
five, six of us.
We saw the first Star Wars to inform what is this about.
Neither of us had seen the first one. Neither of us had seen the first one.
Neither of us had seen it.
So. I'm trying to have some idea of what we were going to do.
There's always an interesting quote that I always recall back to that George Lucas made about he was more worried about the concept and how they would achieve the concept. That would, you know, solving the problem would come later. So for each of you in your different roles, I just wondered, was there a particular problem that you faced and maybe how you overcame that?
No, I think coming into this project, it was to me it was quite new because I hadn't been into any production before because I was a distribution guy. 20th Century Fox of Norway, we imported and distributed pictures to the Norwegian cinemas. So when we got the chance to do this, we found it very, very interesting. It was a great job.
I think for me, strangely, it seems really strange to say it now, but probably the thing I had to overcome was lack of enthusiasm. And it sounds really strange, but as Christian was saying, you know, the first film had been released, and it was a huge hit. I'd gone to see it, and I wasn't impressed. You know, it was too bright, too goody-baddy, too simplistic for me. And I just came off Alien when I was about to start this one. And Alien for me was something, you know, really special because the look of it was amazing. It was dark, it was spooky, and you had Giga's weird monster and fantastic interiors of the spaceships. Everything was, I mean, that was a film that I was really enthusiastic about. So when Brian Johnson said, hey, look, you know, we've got a follow-up, we've got a film to go straight onto, and pulled me out of the workshops where we'd made all the Nostromo models and all the models for the model shoot for Alien, And Ridley Scott was, they were just finishing the main unit shoot and were about to start shooting the models over at Bray Studios, and Brian pulled me out and said, "Look, I want, you know, I've got Star Wars 2, I want you to go over to Elstree and start setting the workshops up." And I was, I want to be in Bray and, you know, Ridley Scott and filming. But of course, you know, I've got a year's work ahead of me. So it's like, I've got a job, great. So do what the boss says. But I wasn't kind of blown away at the thought of working on Star Wars. But you also have to remember that in the 70s, there was no guarantee that Empire Strikes Back was going to be a hit.
Absolutely, yeah.
It could have flopped, you know, it could have been, yeah, because they didn't do sequels in those days. No. Sequels were almost unheard of. You sometimes had, like, Hammer House of Horror.
Yeah.
They would make several vampire films or Frankenstein. I mean, you know, there was that kind of general, there was the Carry-On series. You remember that?
Yeah, it was.
So sequels were a kind of, well, it's a bit of a no-no. Mm-hmm. So when they said, yeah, there's a sequel coming out, there was no guarantee it was going to make any money. And Star Wars as a phenomenon, Star Wars as a kind of iconographic part of film history, that wasn't in the 70s.
No.
That has grown and grown and grown and grown and grown through the subsequent decades. It wasn't in place then. So, yeah, you know, it's an empire. But, I mean, of course, through the course of it, it was a fantastic thing to work on. And really interesting, and you know, there were 1,001 details I could talk about,
sure.
But that was the first kind of, to answer your question, it was about enthusiasm. Oh, Star Wars.
There's maybe an element of that is a positive thing if you're going into a project and you're not caught up in the drama and the hysteria in the media about the project, but you're able just to focus on your job.
Well, the first one, I recently listened to a podcast. What are they called? Filmimentaries?
Jamie Benning,
yeah. And it was the one with Madeline Most, who was the camera assistant. And she talked a lot about that, about filming the first one. When they filmed Star Wars 1, The English crew at Elstree, they were really dismissive. This is some heap of shit. I mean, really, you know, the first assistant apparently was really rude to George Lucas. They were, you know, they were not helpful.
No.
The director of photography was very unhelpful.
Gil Taylor.
I mean, Gil Taylor was a, you know, a big figure.
Yeah.
You know, he was a very famous photographer. Stop. What's this rubbish? So he was very patronising towards Lucas.
Yeah.
Nobody knew that Lucas was this boy genius. Yeah. So
this is an answer by else he doesn't get much of the credit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. No big thanks from Lucas. No. And Johnny Steers, who did the effects on the first film, he went to court with Lucasfilm. Because he felt that he had been a big part of designing R2-D2 and got rapidly bounced out of any idea of royalties on that score.
Yeah.
So he didn't get number two because he'd upset Lucas.
Yeah.
So that's how Brian Johnson was saying. Because Brian Johnson had done a TV series called Space 1999.
Yeah.
That was the, you know, how he got chosen. But no, nobody knew it was going to be, that we would 45 years later be sitting here talking about it.
Yeah.
That was not thinkable at that time.
We do a lot of interviews with different actors and crew folks, and a lot of them, because they're working. We were outside talking in the snow, and he was saying, you know, it was the 70s, we were working men, we were moving from job to job.
Yeah.
And a lot of the actors say, it's a week. I got paid 200 quid, it was a job, that was it.
Yeah,
so it's kind of that.
No, I'm sure all of the, the guy playing Chewbacca and Tony Pearl, the guy playing C3, I mean, the fact that years and years later they could go to conventions all over the States and sign autographs and get, you know, that would have been a major surprise.
Absolutely.
Where did this come from?
Yeah.
But then I was sitting at lunchtime today asking some of the guests here, what is it? You know, what is it about the Star Wars franchise? What is it about those first three films that has made this possible? What is it about? And I was just thinking out loud and saying, is it the fact that it's such an kind of, you've got the good guys and the bad guys, and the good guys win. And yeah, well, it's not just that, because Robin Hood is that too.
Mm.
So what is the charm? What is it that has made Star Wars so fantastically successful and so interesting to you guys? What is it?
I think there's a dozen different reasons.
Yeah.
And I think most people would agree that it's
when
it came out, the age we were when it came out,
yeah,
the merchandise that came along with it.
Yeah.
There was a special kind of magic about that film that hit kids when they were between 8 and 10 years old.
Yeah.
And just the fact that the sequels were so good.
Yeah.
And I always think it's the McCartney thing. When McCartney, he couldn't read music for years, and he said, if I knew how to write a Beatles song, I couldn't write a Beatles song. And Spielberg said the same.
Mm.
If I knew how to do it, it'd become formulaic, and then people would figure me out. So it's kind of better when it's that sort of quicksilver.
So it's just some magic.
Some magic.
Yeah.
Where, you know, we were talking about Rebel Moon, new film that came out on Netflix last year, that everyone said was going to be, they're making big mega smash, and I haven't heard anybody talk about that film for about 2 months.
Yeah.
So, and yet Star Wars, here we are 45 years later,
yeah,
and here we are sitting in Norway talking about it.
Yeah.
So.
The sci-fi film that came out a year or so ago that had a little kid that was a robot with like a hole in the ear.
The Creator.
What was it called?
Creator.
Now, I remember seeing a trailer for that in the cinema thinking, my God, that looks amazing. Ah, wow, look at that. And it disappeared. And I saw it on some one or other of the streaming channels, and it was like, So what makes that kind of, what is it that grabs everybody's attention?
And I think so many other franchises and so many other filmmakers have been reaching for that for decades to try and get their own version of. And a couple have come close.
Yeah.
You know, but no one's ever quite got it.
No, I was talking to some of the guests about my son is now working in London, and he worked on Andor and was down to work on one of the TV spin-offs. And they pulled them back. They've delayed them all. And the Marvel Universe have delayed their films. There's a big question mark about, because they're not doing the business they thought they would do. I mean, what do you think about the TV spin-offs?
Mixed for me, where there's some of them fantastic. Andor series, I absolutely love. But a lot of people say it's not Star Wars because it's so radically different from the kind of storylines we've seen before. Then there's other elements of it where you feel it's a little bit flat and a little bit of a disappointment. Like, there was a lot of excitement over the Obi-Wan Kenobi series, and it just didn't have that spark that ignited my imagination.
Mandalorian? And what did you think of Mandalorian?
First two series I really enjoyed. Last series. But it's also it's all very subjective. I think sometimes it's all about the timing of when a project comes out as well.
Yeah.
And that it just captures the mood of the public at the right point in time.
Yeah.
And I think you see that as well, how like Star Wars has never really caught on significantly in the Asian market. And I think that's something that Disney's trying to correct. And, you know, the next TV series that come out, The Acolyte, has very much an Asian flavour to its style. So you think, you know, they're trying different things to capture that imagination of people.
Yeah.
So I think even
lightsabers are samurai swords.
Like Cheryl said, there's not a formula you can go back to. You've got to find that little bit of magic somewhere.
And as you said, the sort of the zeitgeist, the spark of the time.
I mean, Star Wars is flared trousers, disco. Star Wars and Grease and Saturday Night Fever are kind of all together.
It's
the most of its era of all the films.
Yeah.
You can pin Star Wars to a time. Coming out of that, you know, 3 Day Strikes at Home, Watergate in the States. You know, it's that kind of era. So Star Wars is kind of the gift that era got.
But and maybe a reminder of happier times. Because the world is so threatening now.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's a good point. But it's a safe place when a lot of people have travelled here. It's something that we're passionate about.
Yeah.
You know, certainly.
Yeah. Yeah. And the lady that I was sitting next to at lunch, because I was asking the same question, and she said, no, that's right, she's a teacher, and her husband works in casualty in a hospital. And I said, wow, you know, your two jobs are really important. My job? You know, I spent my life making stuff that's disappeared. You know, it all everything I made ended up in a skip thrown away somewhere, and it exists on film, but does it? You know, you can't even get VHS copies anymore. Nobody uses DVDs anymore.
No.
So, but then she said, yeah, but people need escapism. So perhaps it does fulfill a function.
And I think you're right. It's like, I look at the Andor TV series, and it's probably as far away as Star Wars as you can get. It's not really about the war and the conflict. But if you're turning on the news at the moment, that's all there is yeah. war and conflict. Yeah. So maybe the fact that I enjoy that more is the fact it's something other than war and conflict.
I agree with you. I liked Andor best of all the because it seemed to me, yeah, not so derivative, not just milking the cow. It seemed to be scripts that actually took the universe further.
Yeah.
Mandalorian, I didn't like because I thought so much of the acting was so bad.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just, you know, as you said, subjective.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they gave us Baby Grogu. we love Baby Grogu.
Have the two of you ever experienced this interest for the production side of a movie, like we can now see for The Empire Strikes Back?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm a Star Trek fan as well, don't hit me. And there's definitely an interest there, but in that sort of fandom, I think the interest is as much in the performers and the actors. They very much blend with the characters, so that's kind of different. And there's an interest, but nothing like this. I don't know of any other franchise where you would travel to here or somewhere like here just to be here and feel the flavour of it and speak to gentlemen like you and who are part of it. And you know, there's nothing else I can think. I don't know what you think, Brian.
Yeah. I can't think of anything either. It's, if you're in a city and you maybe can think of a location that was from a movie, you might go there and get your photo taken in front of it. But I can't think of a scenario where you would get so many people, like the number of people in this room would go out their way to travel the distance that so many people have come halfway across the world and more to be together to celebrate something like this.
Mind you, most of the opinion polls that I've read specify Empire Strikes Back as the Star Wars film. I mean, it comes number one of all the Star Wars films. And of The Empire Strikes Back, what is it that stands out? You know, it's as Harold said, it's hot.
Yeah.
That's the glamorous part of it. That's the sort of wow.
And it's also the interesting aspect that the start of the film with the big battle.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it wasn't the climax of the film. It's a very different structure to the film.
Yeah. And the Wampa and the Tauntaun, they got it right. Yeah. They got the elements really right. Cool. And the common, as Harold said, when he went to Elm Street and saw the hangar, in the Star Wars stage built for that set, Millennium Falcon sitting in the middle of that. Sort of what looked like sort of laser cut ice.
Mm-hmm.
It was a brilliant set.
It was
fantastic. So the interiors and the exteriors cut together worked so well.
And how aware were you guys when you were working on it of what would be done at Elm Street?
I had no idea.
You didn't know how it would intercut at all. That's good though, isn't it?
No, I didn't know very much of it. I mean, I worked September to September, and the preparation period, I saw them, obviously I was there in Elm Street when they were building the Star Wars stage, because there wasn't a stage big enough for those two sets, the Bog Planet and the hangar.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what they were going to look like.
No context, there was no context.
No, not at all. I mean, what I remember mostly from that time is I was lying in bed last night preparing myself for this, just trying to get the details right and thinking, was I invited to FINSA first, and then they fitted the torn, built the torn around me because I was going to FINSA. Or did I go to FINSA because I was the smallest guy on the crew? And, you know, I'm not sure.
Totally.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was part, that was the preparation period. I was up in the makeup department a lot, being fitted into that. We made the effects department made the metal work for the, you know, for the sort of seesaw thing that I sat in and that supported the body. But then all the movements for the head, that was Stuart Freeborn's department, and I had to go up and he was adjusting so that I could reach everything and rehearse with it. So there was that, and then building the probe robot arms, because the probe robot had to go, that had to be sent. We had a date where it had to be packed in its box and sent away for Christian to unload at the other end. But then what I mostly remember that period is The Shining.
Mm.
Because The Shining was being filmed in Elstree. Every time The Shining finished with a set, Star Wars would move into it.
Yeah.
So when we were doing preparation at Elstree, The Shining had most of the studio. So I saw, and my brother was working on that,
right.
So I got to get in and see Kubrick sets, which were very special.
Yeah.
Can I ask you about the operating of the Tauntaun?
Yeah.
And how difficult was it? Because it's part of my presentation.
Well, it was mostly uncomfortable, you know, because I'm sitting on this, I had this uncomfortable seat and something to rest my feet on, and my arms were up here with a bunch of rods. I couldn't see what I was doing. And if you remember the piece from the film this morning,
because it was in one the making of book that I think it was Alan Tompkins off the top of my head who commented that it was incredibly difficult to work with. I think we had a discussion on Friday, and you thought he was maybe referencing
I think he was talking about the Wampa. Because he was talking about how heavy it was to carry on your shoulders. I didn't have any weight on me.
Yeah.
That was all on the frame. Whereas Des Webb, you know, the poor guy in that Wampa suit, I mean, that was a struggle.
Yeah, I think he talked about how painful it was and the whole performance for him.
Yeah. But looking at that, looking at that film this morning, or those segments that you showed this morning, of me in that thing, and Irving Kershner's, it's too jerky, it's too jerky. And of course, nobody had told me. I didn't get schooled in making slow and ponderous movements as a creature of that size.
Absolutely.
Should have been. Yeah. I was just like, well, I'll pull this and I'll do that and see what they say. And what they said was, it's too jerky. It's too jerky. So I had to slow it down. But I mean, really, I should have spent a number of hours with people feeding back, and I move like them. No, take that bit slower and move the eyes. No, that doesn't work. Yeah. Nothing.
No,
nothing.
Straight in, deep end.
Deep end. Yeah.
For everything in one location, daily news, reviews, interviews, podcasts, video, and social media feeds. Bookmark FanthaTracks.com for Star Wars news 24/7, 365.
Christian, in your role in the production, you were there from pre-production?
From early January to Easter. Yeah.
And what aspect was the most challenging for you? Was there something that... Because I went...
The first most challenging was too many working hours.
Yeah.
I mean, I went up at 6. I was up there starting the vehicles at 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
Cleaning the snow. Sometimes there were... blown all the snow into them and packed the snow and tanking, filling the tanks and get the people off and driving some of them up to the road, coming back I had to back some of the trailers back into the tents, filling in the tanks again, and it was midnight before I finished.
Yeah. There was
7 days a week.
A lot of people on the production talked about it was the camaraderie of the crew that got them through it, because there were so many, it must have been demoralizing. It's like when you've worked so hard to create the trenches and you go back the next day and they're completely filled in, and it's just in that kind of environment, it must have been.
I didn't dig the trenches, thanks God. But one thing is quite important about why this when I worked on it, it was not important for me the result. Is that when I worked in a Norwegian production, where we were at that time in the 70s, we were a crew of 20 people, and it was the DOP and me. I was used to work as a gaffer, so I worked closely with the DOP. And then you have an influence on the result of the film. Mm. Here, I was just a tiny little piece. Nobody cared. I didn't know what I didn't hadn't seen in the script. I had no idea.
Yeah.
You were just doing what we were told. But in the films I were used to work on, I had an influence, and that's a big difference.
Yeah.
Then you get enthusiastic or you hate it. But I mean, here it was just another work. Mm-hmm.
Just hard work. Because the hours, the temperatures, that battle sequence. I mentioned these steel boxes. I mean, just to manoeuvre those steel boxes into their positions when you're knee deep in snow.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's a major undertaking just to drag these things.
Just walk for yourself.
Just to walk for yourself. And then having set the metal boxes into place, then you have to run out cables back to the firing position. Again, you saw the distances involved.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And then having run out the cables, you have to fill them up after every shot with bags of cement or peat or cork or, you know, it's just exhausting.
Yeah, and constantly cleaning up and making sure everything
packs in. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we mentioned this virgin snow.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking of that, yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, because you know what virgin snow means.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No footprints.
No footprints, no tracks, nothing. And you had to drive out all the supplies to very mid explosions like that. You couldn't drive anywhere. That'd be very, very specific on which tracks you could use, which tracks you could walk in. And I remember when we came up to the location with all the equipment, we need to turn around and we need, I mean, those vehicles needed like 200 meter diameter to turn around, big. And it was so complicated if you want to overtake another one, because then you were driving to the virgin snow, you know. And that was quite a hassle. That slowed us down in many ways, and we got stuck, and we had to back up with the trailers and without touching the snow outside the tracks. Yeah.
And we the rebel soldiers, when the 80s came, we had to run in between all these explosives. Martin was just sitting there, fire them off, and we had to run and not to step on them.
Yeah,
that was quite interesting.
I don't know. So a lot of it is time consuming. I mean, obviously you've got a plan of what's going to be done, so you know what's going to be done.
Mm.
But from the way you all describe what you did, it's not a lot of resetting.
No, take two would take a long time to reset.
Yeah,
absolutely. Which is, of course, one of the major advantages of CGI.
Yeah.
Is that when they put all the explosions in afterwards, they can just keep filming and keep filming. And, you know, it's a. I mean, CGI has you can't underestimate just what a revolution CGI has been in the film business, because it. I mean, Virgin Snow, for example. You can just paint it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wires. I worked on one film, a film called Brazil, Terry Gilliam's Brazil, where we had in his dreams the main character could fly. So there were a number of dream sequences of him with wings flying. So we made a 1-8 scale mechanical model hanging from very thin piano wires. And we spent weeks filming that on a model stage with a painted background and artificial clouds. And it would look great. We'd watch the rushes the next day and it would look great, great. And then suddenly you'd see a wire just glinting. It would just, one of the wires would catch a light.
Yeah.
And it's, I would say probably 90% of what we filmed was thrown away because of even though you sprayed them all carefully blue and, you know, nowadays you could use wires that were thick and you leave them visible and they just take them away.
But I think you've inadvertently hit on another reason why Star Wars is so loved, because people who know how it was made know the effort and the time that you guys put in, ILM put in, and all the all the constituent parts. If you made Empire Strikes Back now, today, with all the technology we've got, you mentioned the creator, that's probably going to win the Oscar for visual effects. It's phenomenal. But it wouldn't be the Empire Strikes Back.
No.
It just wouldn't. There'd be too many tools in the toolbox. The temptation to do too much would be there.
Which I think that was the trap that Lucas fell into with The Phantom Menace 3.
Yeah.
Those, you know, the prequels. I think he had too big a paintbox.
Unlimited power.
Yeah, and I think it showed, because it was like overkill, for me at least.
Sure.
Yeah. Compared to the first three.
Yeah.
And for Kirshner and the photographers to see what they have filmed, we had every night to send 2 days shooting with a night train either to Bergen or to Oslo, depending on which way was open.
Yeah.
And then over to London, develop, and back again. It took us a couple of days before they could see what they filmed, and that. That was quite
shooting in the dark almost,
aren't
it?
Yeah, shooting in the dark, very much.
Yeah. I worked on one film with Peter MacDonald later, our practice, I was on second unit with Peter. Peter was directing second unit, and we would, at lunchtime, go to the viewing theatre to watch the rushes of the stuff we'd shot the day before.
Right.
And one day we went to the viewing theatre, and they started the roll, and it was all black. I mean, there was nothing there. And as we came out, I turned to Peter and said, what was that? He said, I fucked up. Like, that simple.
Yeah, yeah. I thought you were going to say lens cap.
No. It was just, you know, he put the wrong stop or something.
Yeah, yeah.
He fucked up. Well, Peter MacDonald was so good at his job.
Yeah.
That he would survive that,
yeah.
Because the other 99 days or whatever would be, you know, magnificent.
Yeah.
So the office would not, they'd allow him a fuck up. But yeah, of course, because they, as you say, you know, take 2 days to get the rushes back, and then maybe you've got to go and do a retake of stuff because it didn't work, or because there was a hair in the gate, or because you know, some stupid technical problem.
Yeah.
So when you can see it immediately. You know, the CGI is even though I hate it, it's a revolution.
Yeah, it's a useful tool in that respect.
Oh, isn't it? And also, I was talking with Christian, because Christian has his own lighting firm, and we were talking about the fact that digital cameras are so much more light sensitive. So you don't need the amount of lamps you used to need.
Yeah.
I mean, Knut
Haraldsson.
I was talking to Knut about another gaffer, a Norwegian gaffer, and he said, thank God for digital cameras, because as he's got now in his close to 60 or over 60, it's all small lamps and lightweight cables. Yeah. And he said, thank God it's not the great big lamps I started with.
Yeah.
So it's a huge difference.
You're not carrying even only the stands for these big 18K lights, both in the snow in the winter and do heavy cables.
It's
killing me.
I
stopped doing that when I was 15.
Is there also a change in attitude in terms of George Lucas wanted a nice planet, even when everyone was telling him he can't do special effects on a white background, where the attitude today would probably be the complete opposite? They would start from what can we achieve, rather than start from the point of this is what I creatively want to achieve. I think that must be a big part of the change in.
I wonder how much having a massive amount of choice, how much of that is a help or how much of it is a hindrance. You know, it could be that the limitations that one has, if you've got a whole bunch of limitations, then you can be really artistic within that framework.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's the shark in Jaws. The less you see, the more alien. Yeah. The less you see the alien, the scarier it is.
And so if you could have had a CGI shark and they'd used it a lot, maybe the film wouldn't have been, half as good.
No, it's the threat of
it's
not
what you don't see.
Yeah.
Maybe the same with Alien, with the first one, where Ridley Scott was very, very careful to never show full figure until the final bit where it was hanging from the escape pod.
Yeah.
The only time you ever saw the whole creature, The rest of the time, it was just a tail, a bit of head, claws.
Yeah,
the tongue. Yeah. Yeah. So it's what
the imagination.
It's
the fear of the unknown.
The fear of the unknown. Yeah. This threat.
Okay.
Yeah. What we don't see is worse than what we do see.
Totally.
Yeah.
Has anyone out in the audience got any questions that I'd like to ask our guests?
Please.
I'll go for it, Andy.
I've seen some aerial photos. This is a very technical question about the filming in Finse. Aerial photographs showing some turrets, the rebel gun turrets, set up just down by the tented village where you had the workshops and things. So there are two turrets stood there. Just wondering whether you did any filming, whether it was second unit, whether it was explosions.
No, they were just placed there before they were taken up onto the glacier.
Definitely.
Nothing was done with them there, because those turrets, we had the special effects department. We had an oxyacetylene rig to make them fire. So it was possible that we could make an explosion come out of them. And one of our guys, Philip Knowles, was in one of the rebel costumes, because he had to duck inside it and turn the gas off between takes. So, but all those were done on the battle site.
Thank you.
There wasn't anything shot here.
One for Harold, really. Obviously, the success from Empire, did it put kind of 20th century Norway on the map, and did that kind of open doors for other productions to come to Norway?
Well, I think it probably did a couple of years later, but because at the time we had not many international productions here, and nobody knew about this production before we started, before we had the big press conference in Oslo, and then they started to get interested, and I think it put Norway and also the 20th Century Fox of Norway on the map.
Yeah.
And for us locally in 20th Century Fox of Norway, it really put us on the map. So we got a big star in the 20th Century Fox organization. That was great for us.
Yeah.
And also it was box office, I think, the Empire Strikes Back for us in Norway, as far as I remember, was even bigger than Star Wars. It was a big success.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that stops foreign films coming here is that it's a very expensive country. Like, everything costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
When people hear about the cost of food, the cost of restaurants, the cost of beer, cost of transport, it's like, whoa, it's, they want to go and shoot in cheap places where they can get stuff for nothing.
Tom Cruise is coming.
He likes it here. I mean, there is spectacular nature. He's coming for the nature.
Yeah.
I mean, he did that motorcycle job.
Yeah, that was it. Some friends of us, they were in the Åndalsnes that day, and they stopped all the traffic. And as far as I heard from them, he had 7 jumps before they were satisfied. 7 motorcycles, everything. But they still have one in the Åndalsnes, and they're going to display it in the square.
But shortly after the Empire, Superman 2 came up.
Yeah,
I was on that with Elin Eriksson for, I think it was a year.
What did they do? I worked on the English end of that. What did they do here?
They did, what's his name?
Alan Brando.
No.
No, he was in the first one.
Christopher Reeve.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was kind of coming out of the white.
He went walking off into the Fortress of Solitude, did the image of walking back.
Yeah, and it was a big truck with oil pipes passing by. It was supposed to be shot in Alaska, but they did it in Norway because it was cheaper.
The diner, it stops with the diner.
Yeah. It was only a couple of days. He was a nice guy, Christopher, actually.
He was a very nice guy.
Very nice guy.
Yeah.
You mentioned what a nice guy Mark Hamill was. I mean, we kind of know that, but you really
Mark Hamill was a lovely guy. He was really, really sweet. He was unaffected. He didn't have any kind of stuck-up star stuff about him. He was just a really nice feet on the ground guy. He was really sweet. Really, just a pleasure to work with. Lovely guy. Very few of them are accessible like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that they're all horrible, but they're. You know, I think that when they're not performing, they probably get this whole fan thing must be exhausting.
Yeah.
So they just kind of, you know, you don't. Very few of them you get close to.
I think when they are climbing, trying to get famous, they are worse. When they are up there, they are more relaxed.
Yeah, maybe.
I worked in Bergen in the Donald Sutherland, and he was fantastic, crazy guy, very nice, very friendly.
Robert De Niro invited me to a party in Buenos Aires. Martin, come and sit with me in my car. Yeah, all right, Bob. But it doesn't happen very often.
Was that on the mission?
The mission,
Yeah. That was a tough thing to work on.
That was a great thing to work on.
Yeah, but it was hard, wasn't it?
It was hard, but it was a wonder. I mean, 5 months in South America? Thanks very much.
Any more questions?
So yesterday we saw a bunch of pictures about the decision making bringing Empire Strikes Back here, and so there were a lot of figures on these pictures, but I don't remember seeing George Lucas anywhere. So was he completely uninvolved with the whole project, or what's the story on this?
I think I didn't
hear the question.
Yeah, he was asking if George Lucas was involved in the process.
Was George Lucas involved in the planning? Did you ever see
him? We never saw him. No. We just dealt with Gary Kurtz, and then George Lucas was never here, and we never met him. So Gary Kurtz, I think, to us he was the producer.
Mm. Yeah, very much.
100%.
Yeah, very much.
And he was very nice guy to work with.
He was Gary Kurtz was. I mean, he was a strange guy. He was a he was a Mormon for a start.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the strange beard.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't drink. You know, and very stone faced. Yeah. I can hardly ever remember seeing him smile. I mean, he was always just super serious, and he was just like this shadow. He was just around all the time, just watching. And so I had much more to. I mean, we had much more to do with the English production office.
Yeah.
Robert Watts. Bruce Sharman, Phil Kohler, Gary Kurtz was just this sort of superior distant figure who was there just to watch it.
When they were doing the recce, trying to decide on a location, were they shooting footage here as well as photographs? I'm just wondering if what information might have went back.
Stills pictures.
Oh, yeah.
There were no. I mean, this was even before video.
Yeah.
So I guess you could theoretically they could have shot Super 8 or something, but no, it was just stills.
Oh, yeah.
Just took lots of stills. Ooh,
But we had Gary Kurtz as a guest in Oslo about 1 week before going up here, and then private. He was a very nice guy.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, we went to some museums. We went to Frognerseteren to have dinner, and he was a very, very private guy.
Yeah.
So then he was very nice.
Yeah.
Then he wasn't the stone face.
As
he was here.
That's what professional side.
I think he was really. He was a shy guy.
Yeah.
He was shy.
Probably coloured by the fact that my boss, Brian Johnson, the special effects chief at Elstree, he was invited to a party with Gary Kurtz. And the following day we said, how did that go, Brian? He said, that was weird. There was no alcohol. it was like carrot juice, and which is unheard of in Britain. It was like, as I said to some of you earlier, you know, but. The film business in the 70s in Britain, it was very boozy. There was lots of alcohol. Everybody drank at lunchtime. And I can remember once I was in Elstree and one of the riggers actually fell out of the studio roof, what they call the reds, which was these steel girders. You fell out of the roof onto the stage floor, which was like a three-story drop. And he didn't die. And they said the
because
only
he was drunk.
Because he was drunk. Yeah. Yeah. he fell like a rag doll. And I mean, he maybe he broke some bones, but he didn't die.
He didn't die. That's great.
So yeah, a party with Gary Kurtz where there's no alcohol. That would be
strange guy.
But in private, he was probably really.
He was another other guy private. Yeah.
Yeah.
Logistics for the operation in a way where obviously you had that big convoy of train carriages initially. Now what happened on a daily basis? Were you getting resupplies of various things, diesel or petrol?
It was coming in every day, barrels and barrels of fuel.
Yeah,
it was just
and alcohol.
Not every day. And I mean, it was supplies coming every day.
And that was your responsibility to.
Sometimes.
We had a buyer, the special effects department, with Dag Alverberg. He was going back to Oslo to look up things were coming up the railway line.
At that time, they had the train leaving all station going to Voss every day, both ways, which was only supplies. I think you could travel with it as a passenger, but it was only made for supplies, not for us only, but for everywhere. People having hut cottages and stuff. But the hotel depended a lot on that. And today, that's a problem for the hotel here to get supplies, because the train stops for 2 minutes, and you have to, if you need, get some new sofas or whatever, bathtubs or God knows what. You have to get everything off in like
quick together.
Yeah. So for them, it's when that train stops working, that was a big problem for them. But for us, that was fantastic. But we didn't get all these 27 carriages with supplies at one time. It was two, three sometimes, maybe just half of one day. And when we got all the vehicles. That was a lot. And you had to drive them off down on the platform. It was a little complicated. And then the passenger train was going to pass, and that had to be on the platform side, so we had to back up and go on to the other track and wait for the passenger train to leave again and go back and start all over again. Took a lot of time. Yeah, a lot of work. And the same way to get everything back.
Yeah.
And the big huts, they came in, they were not built here, they came in as a barracks kind of, but they were heavy.
Mm.
And to get them off the train was really tricky. That was problem.
I bet putting them up was hard work too.
Yeah, you had to tow them up. The rat tracks towed them up.
Really?
Yeah, that could do anything.
Yeah, I mean,
that was a tough machine.
Yeah. Where did that come from? Because
it's a slalom downhill slope somewhere in Norway. They use it for.
Because the other ones came from Sweden, didn't they?
Snow tracks came from Sweden.
Yeah.
Do you remember the name of the company?
They all came from Sweden. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a Volkswagen engine. But the gearbox were kind of mirror wise, so it was very confusing to drive them first to second. And with the belts, it's a very heavy thing, heavy machinery to move around. So when you get in the first gear, you know, and you get up the speed a little bit, and you want to get in the second, and you have like half a second. If not, you stop again, and you have to go back and try to get up the speed. It was complicated. And if you turn the steering wheel without moving, you broke something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then Jöran, the Swedish guy, had to come in and climb under there and start dismantling the thing and put it back.
They weren't easy to drive, were they?
No, not at all. Not at all.
No, it was a knack you had to learn.
Because the steering is kind of, you're slowing one belt.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can't turn the belts. It's just slowing, breaking one of them or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, complicated machinery. Yeah.
For each of you, I just wondered if you had a lasting memory, something that's always stuck with you over the past 45 years. That
yeah, the girl from the ski lodge.
What was her name?
I can't remember. It wasn't that part of her I remember.
Today she's 82.
Yeah, no, she's well, she was 10 years younger than me, so she's 63 now.
63.
Yeah. One of the best stories is you were asking for the condoms for the, you know, from the shop. You all heard that story today? No.
About the condoms?
Yeah.
Well, I heard about it.
Yeah, no. So it's they need to use condoms for not for explosives, but for the.
Well, we use them for bullet hits, to have blood in. So I don't.
Yeah.
But I don't remember there being bullet hits. Did we do bullet hits here?
I don't know. You should know.
I should know. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sort of fit with the universe, you know.
Yeah.
Scouts of blood. Yeah. Right?
No. You think you make made bombs in them?
Would you want petrol in them to make them explode with a little flash on the plane?
It could have. Yeah, it could have been that. It could have been that. Then they were for fuel.
Anyway, they asked for. Suddenly, they needed 12 dozens of condoms. Mm-hmm. And it was this shop at the end of the platform here. That was a regular shop at the time. And Elin Eriksen went in there and asked the girl there behind the counter for 12 dozens of condoms. And she says, oh, I'm sorry, we only have 3 in stock, but we can get more tomorrow. And Elin says, yeah, okay, until tomorrow. Oh, I hope that will do. And of course, she knew that it was 3 girls on the whole crew and 100 men. The girl behind the counter, she had some. Weird idea.
Harold, as well, did you have a memory of something that stuck with you over the years? And obviously, you talked.
My memory is mainly to be able to work for 2 years together with a very international team and very professional people. That was a fantastic experience. So I really recall that 2 years I was engaged by Chapter 2 Productions as a very, very nice period because of all the people. Everybody very nice and very professional.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I always remember, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was sharing with some of the guests here outside this morning. The first film was nobody took it very seriously, you know, the crew. It was just another small, low-budget American film. But this one, I mean, this was a whole different ball game. I mean, it was all the heads of department were at the top of their game.
Yeah.
They were the first assistant director, Dave Tomlin, was the best in Britain. Peter McDonald, the second director, was the best in Britain. Norman Reynolds, the production designer, was extremely good. Mm. This was a cream crew.
But Bill Wesley.
He was very well known as a he was a very effective. I mean, you saw on that documentary with him telling the Norwegian actors how to use. Yeah, I mean, he was very energetic. He was a difficult guy, but he was. He threw himself into it like crazy. You know?
But he was first assistant director on second unit.
On the second unit,
I was, for 2 weeks, I was second assistant director.
Under Bill?
Under Bill.
Wow.
And I didn't understand a word of what he was saying. I didn't sing there. So I had to try to imagine what he might be saying. He was screaming that in a megaphone to the rest of the Norwegian extras.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I asked when Peter McDonald was here, just before the COVID, and I said, to work out to Bill Wesley, that was really difficult. I didn't understand a word of what he was saying. And Peter said, I don't understand him. I said, oh God, thank God. And he said, that's the only second assistant director I know who don't read the script and he don't have a watch. But he's doing his job well.
I worked with Bill again on The Mission and on Richard Attenborough's Cry of Freedom and Memphis Belle. Mm. The Mission and Memphis Belle, and Bill was great on both of them.
Mm.
But I met somebody. I was in Bergen a few years ago, and one of the Norwegian crew, and he had done a commercial outside Bergen with Bill. And by that time, I think Bill was probably
That was a Hallmark commercial we made here.
Was it? Yeah. Did you have crew from Bergen?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have, and Bill was on that.
Yeah.
Well, they said that he was, you know, drinking too much and.
The trouble with that production was that the cameraman and the director hated each other.
It doesn't.
So that was a good reason for drinking too much. That was hell.
Yeah, but they were, no, it was a very good, it was a top crew. Mm. Really. And the camera operators, Mike Brewster was one of them. He was like second camera or third camera. And Peter McDonald is had him as a kind of, you know, he was under Peter's wing. And when we were here last time, 4 or 5 years ago, Peter was talking about how much respect he's got for Mike Brewster. So, yeah, some really, really good people. The prop crew, Charlie Talbot. Do you remember Charlie Talbot? Really good, really good people. Yeah, and, yeah, you know, among the top flight.
It's good that he did, because Lucas bet the farm on that second film, didn't he? And luckily, it came through.
And Robert Watts. You know,
legend.
Really clever guy. Really, really clever guy.
I can't imagine any of you would have imagined you'd be here 45 years later talking about it.
No way.
I just wondered how it feels to have your work that you, you know, you did talk about and celebrated all these years on.
No, of course it's wonderful. It's wonderful. It's a little bit slightly. I mean, the only slight. The galling factor is if you look up my name, if you type in Martin Gann on the internet, what comes up is this.
Yeah.
And you know, there's another 50 films.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's this is the one. This is the one that I am remembered for, which was right at the start of my career. So I was as a snow shoveler, you know, shoveling snow into a wind machine and racing around with a smoke gun. What I did 40 years later as a production designer, where I was, you know, designing the whole set, you know, that's forgotten. It's the shoveling work
of I think we've used up all of our time.
I think we have.
Unless anyone has any last questions they want to ask.
Speak one in.
Quick question. Talking about equipment and props, was there anything lost in the snow? I heard rumors that Star Wars fans are strolling around there in the summertime, so looking for.
I'm sure somebody found something later on, but I think they did a very thorough job cleaning up in the summer, didn't they?
Mm. I think so.
Oh, there was a cleanup crew, wasn't
there?
There was a cleanup crew, yes.
Yeah. Okay. But I'm sure, of course, it's something.
There is something up there.
It will be something.
So, just go on.
Feel free, but do it in the summer. Not now.
Thank you.
And any time tonight or tomorrow, ask us.
Mm.
We are not anxious.
Yes.
That's what we're here for.
That's brilliant. Guys, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Big round of applause. Good.
If you want to be part of the action, visit fanthatrax.com or be sure to comment, like and share on our social media feeds at Fanthatrax. Send in your listeners' questions by emailing radio@fanthatrax.com. Subscribe, leave a review, preferably a 5-star one, on Amazon Music, Audible, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher or smart speaker of choice. And as always, thanks to James Temple for composing the Fanthatrax intro, Adam O'Brien for our making tracks opening music, and Mark Daniel and Vanessa Marshall for our voiceovers. Tune in to Good Morning Tatooine. It's live Sunday evenings, 9 o'clock UK, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch. And check out our Fanthatrax Radio Friday night rotation every Friday at 7 o'clock UK time for new episodes of The Phantom from Down Under, Planet Layer, Desert Planet Discs, Start Your Engines, Collecting Tracks, Cannon Fodder, and special episodes of Making Tracks, and every Tuesday at 7 o'clock UK time for your weekly episode of Making Tracks. And remember, Fanthatrax.com, our social media feeds, Fanthatrax TV, and Fanthatrax Radio are absolutely so no Patreon, Buy Me a Coffee, Kickstarter or Indiegogo required to stay updated on all the latest Star Wars news.
Until we catch up with you again, may the Force be with you.
Coming up next on Fantha Tracks Radio, it's Collecting Tracks.